What's up, everybody? This week I'm joined by Greg Gregory as we sit down and talk about one of the greatest Disney movies of all time, Disney's Aladdin. That and a whole lot more is to come on this week's episode of the 90s Podcast. Welcome to the show. Hey, everybody, what's going on? This is John here, and I'm joined by Greg Gregory. Greg, man, it's good to have you back. How are you doing?
Hey, good, man. What's up?
Nothing much, man. It's been a very, very busy week. First things first, before we go ahead and get started, I want to thank everybody. I'm recording this a couple of weeks before it comes out, and I just wanted to say that the Dumb and Dumber episode was our fastest downloaded episode of all time.
Nice.
So it got to its point, got to its weekend overview downloads quicker than any other episode that we've ever done.
Awesome. Yeah, we shared it several times on the Holodex social media.
Nice.
So I'm hoping that helped.
Yeah.
Because, you know, people like the 90s, and our people especially are like pretty crazy about it. So I'm really hoping Holodex Nation helped you out on that one.
Thank you, man. And trust me when I say I appreciate it. I appreciate every share.
Oh,
I appreciate every And... you know, once again, thank you to everybody who's taking the time to download it. I didn't mention it last week because, like I said, last week hasn't been released yet. So it's been recorded, but it hasn't been released yet because I'm recording these a couple of weeks in advance. So plus,
oh yeah, you gotta stay up.
Plus, I've made an executive decision, and we're extending the season by 6 episodes. So instead of finishing in a couple of in about a month or so, we're gonna keep going until mid July.
Cool.
And one of the reasons I'm doing that is because I didn't want to do a special episode on its own. This year, I've decided that we are doing Independence Day around Independence Day weekend.
Nice.
A couple of years ago, it would have been on Independence Day, but the second is as close as we're going to get. So,
yeah, that's all that matters. You could really on Independence Day, maybe.
Yeah, maybe I could.
That's get it to that, really.
Yeah,
maybe, I don't know.
But that's coming on later in the season. Right now, we're here to talk about another movie that was big, and we're going to talk about Disney's Aladdin.
Yes, yeah, man. Early 90s offering, but a very, very good one, and you know, just very kind of set the tone for what 90s animated, you know, family style movies were going to be for the next 10, 15 years.
Oh yeah, it's pivotal. It's absolutely pivotal. And not only is it pivotal, it's got a lot of things that changed the animation industry. Some not for the better, I should say. Some for the better, some not for the better.
And I'll get
to that here in a minute, because you know, there's a lot of changes that were made because of one man. And that man is the great Robin Williams.
I was going to say, just shot in the dark, it had to be Robin Williams because he was such a good dude.
Oh yeah, and not that him being in this movie was a bad thing. He made this movie. Let's not be frank. Oh, yeah. He made this movie, but it's who he was and what he was changed animation forever, especially on a big scale like this.
Yeah, I mean this is a major movie, and it's one of those ones that it's still talked about, still screened, kids still enjoy it. Older millennials and Gen Z kids grew up watching it or saw it in the theaters.
Yep.
You know, so it's relatable to it was one of those ones that came out, it was like instant classic.
Definitely.
Boom, immediately.
So let's go through the information real quick. This is an animated musical fantasy movie. It was directed by John Musker and Ron Clements, produced by John Musker and Ron Clements. It was production by Disney Pictures, distributed by Disney and Buena Vista. And this was released on the 11th of 11, 1992. So it's right on time for the Christmas period to get the kids in the movie theater, you know?
Yeah, it's a bigger season than a lot of people may think. The Christmas Thanksgiving season,
yes,
is a huge time to go to the theaters. I never really noticed it much, but then I went to go see a movie in my teens on Christmas Eve, and like the Tinseltown parking lot, it's got to be, you know, I don't know, like 17 rows of of parking spot. They were all full. Like there was nowhere to park at all. I was like, oh, okay, I guess we'll go rent one. You know, so yeah, but it's pretty insane. So that was, I think part of their success might have had to do with the perfect timing of its release.
Yeah, and you know, it's for most of the country, most of the world at that time, or at least this side of the world, it's cold and wet and miserable. And this movie takes place in, you know, in the Middle East, which is not known for its cold weather. Let's put it that way.
Dry
and warm, and yeah, so that was another escape for a lot of people, especially that time of year.
Sure, yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, I didn't really consider that, because with the time when I saw it, I lived in a desert.
Mm.
So to me, it was just like relatable. So it wasn't a break for me. So I guess it has to, you know, if you're from the outback, maybe it would just seem familiar. But I guess for everybody else, like in Canada or up north or the UK or, you know, all that, it is a nice little reprieve from, you know, getting blasted by old man winter over and over again.
Yeah. This did an amazing $504 million at the box office.
That is incredible.
For an animated movie?
Yeah, and especially if you look at what, you know, the profit, and that's the biggest thing is, I mean, how... It's one thing if you made $504 million, but if it cost you $503 million to make it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like,
looking at you, Waterworld.
Yeah, right.
But actually, this made a lot of money. A lot of money.
Really did.
$476.1 million. That was
just box office?
That's just box office. That doesn't include Spaceballs the T-shirt, Spaceballs the video game, nothing like that.
Yeah, multi-platform video game. Not to mention VHS, DVD, and Blu-ray sale. I'm sure there's legacy sales still going on for that.
Disney
that's got to be a billion. It's got to be a billion-dollar franchise by now, easily.
Definitely.
And with all the rights being sold to various streaming platforms, people renting it. I'd looked up, you can rent it on various platforms. You can watch on Apple TV. So Apple TV is giving them a cut. So yeah, that's still a money machine to this day.
Oh yeah, definitely. And this scored an 89 out of 100 on the Jonometer, which for those of you who don't know or new to the Jonometer, that's where you take Rotten Tomatoes score, the two IMDb scores, and you smash them together to make an average.
So that's one of the higher ones I've heard from you.
89 out of 100. That's insane.
Remarkable. Because normally, like, we reviewed, like, a legendary movie. It was Wayne's World. It was, like, 73. I was like, what? So, I mean, when you weigh everything to get a number that high, it's very, very incredible. So, yeah, that's a testament to the quality of this movie.
I mean, it was insane. I mean, Disney movies were blasé at that point. You know, you had Beauty and the Beast that came out the year before. And The Little Mermaid that came out the year before that. But at the same time, you know, Disney movies weren't cool.
They weren't edgy. They were kind of
bland.
Neutered, kind of bland. Yeah, some. But, I mean, this one seemed to have a little more attitude.
Yes.
A little more personality. And even though they seem to retool the tried and true underdog story. I mean, essentially is what we're looking at here, a rags to riches underdog. And it's retooled wonderfully, expertly, and, you know, with the Robin Williams there, another one of those instances, like Jim Carrey in Dumb and Dumber, if you were listening last week, like if he hadn't been there, it would probably been totally different.
Definitely.
In every possible way.
Definitely, because they recast Robin Williams for the first sequel with Dan... I can never pronounce his name correctly. Dan Castanella?
Castanella?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a hard one. Lano? I don't know. I have to look it up.
Homer Simpson, basically.
Yeah, exactly. And among others, but most notably, Homer.
And
I think he has Grandpa as well and a few others. Yeah.
But that changed the picture dynamically because he wasn't as wacky. It was more...
Yeah.
It was more comedic, but not wacky. So in 88, songwriter and lyricist Howard Asham wanted to make a musical adaptation of Aladdin, which, to be fair, the story of Aladdin is something that could translate to a movie theater really, really well. short stories are always the easiest to translate to movies because the character development is so short and so intense right. that you get the character straight away. You know, you don't have to spend time building them up. And when you adapt a short story, it's always clearer. Like, you know, we Christmas Carol, for example, is a short.
They'd sum it up in a song.
Yeah.
Like, they'd sing, like, in the beginning, he sings a song, and you, like, know exactly what's up with him exactly. and, like, who he is and what he's doing. You know, like, yeah. just 2 minutes, boom, you're now fully informed. Yeah, exactly.
So it's easier to do short stories than full-length books if you do in, you know, adaptations. So he wrote a 40-page treatment, which was faithful to the source and materials, but he wanted it in, like, this 1930s campy style, which... That was so blasé in 1989. Yeah. You know, I mean, even the kids' movies of that day, of those days. Look at Honey, I Shrunk the Kids that came out around about that time. You know, I mean, that was an incredible story. It was realistically shot and everything like that. It was far away from campy as possible. And now you want to put Disney back in the campy world.
I don't know what the tone they were going for was, but to me, it came off as like a genuine offering.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, they were trying to be as area period correct as they could to that. And even as far as like the music and those sort of things, and that like the bazaar and the streets and the animals, you know, they really tried hard to do that. But I think they avoided the campiness with a little authenticity, and then also just having the music is just superb. All the songs are just really seriously addictive, easy to remember, still popular. You go to karaoke, somebody's always going to sing A Whole New World or Prince Ali. Like, it's happening, you know. So, I mean, I'm really glad that they avoided the campy version.
Definitely, because Disney was not interested, so they sent Ashman and his partner Alan Menken. They were shunted off to the side to work for Beauty and the Beast,
which is a great film too.
Yeah, and it had some great songs and everything like that, and that was a little campy.
It kind of was. I think that felt like that was aimed more at the little girls.
Yeah,
because it's kind of like a princess story, if you will. You know, for the just to sake of argument, but this one, I think this one was more approachable. To like everyone, kind of like The Lion King. It was like something you can watch, everybody can watch too and enjoy. It's not necessarily like The Little Mermaid that's kind of pandering a little towards the little girls again, you know what I mean? So
yeah, definitely, because what happened was Linda Wolverton picked up the project and got the directors on board, and they had three projects which they could choose from, which it was Aladdin, Swan Lake, or King of the Jungle, which would become The Lion King. And script was
that's
written.
That's a good first draft title, though, I gotta say real quick. King of the Jungle, that's pretty good.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And the problem was is that they wrote a draft of the script, and studio head hated the story and demanded that the whole script be written, but didn't change the release date of the movie. Which, for an animated movie, that's tough. That's something that, you know, you can't...
It's a lot of you're gonna have to scrap a lot of that. Like, your backgrounds and stuff would be fine, but like the close-ups and a lot of the voice animation and stuff like that, like, I mean, most of it's gonna have to go bye-bye. So yeah, that's like a whole redo pretty much.
Well, some of the elements that were changing this movie, the ages of both Aladdin and Jasmine went from 14 and 15 to 18, and an age hinted to be 18. I think it was 17 actually, because they had to be married by the next birthday. So, that's a little icky.
right.
Aladdin's mother was cut out completely, and Apu went from being Aladdin's mentor to his monkey.
Why are moms always absent in Disney films?
I don't know.
Because, like, if you think about it, Beauty and the Beast, it's Belle and her dad. No, in this one, there's no mom. Like, it just never seemed that Ariel is King Triton and Ariel. You know what I mean? Like... It just seems like Bambi. There's a mom. They shoot her in the first 10 seconds of the movie. Spoiler alert. So it's like Disney hates moms or something. Like, I don't know what the deal is. Like, they refuse to let a mom, like, survive in this period of time. I don't know what it was.
It's got to be cliched now because, I mean, the first Toy Story, which was a Pixar movie in association with Disney, they had a mom but no dad.
Hmm. Yeah, so, I was about to say, or you don't see him.
No.
And maybe he's like at the stock market all day or something, the business, the business factory, cranking out businesses all day.
God. So the other thing that they changed from the main script was they said in the fictional Agrabah instead of Baghdad, which I think was a good idea because, you know, the Gulf War had just happened. And I don't think a lot of people want to see a movie based out of Baghdad.
Why add tension to a situation that's already developing and, you know, possibly going to go totally nuts? Yeah, why not?
Yeah.
You know, and I heard that there was actually people that thought Agrabah was an actual place. They're like, should we invade Agrabah? And they're like, oh, totally. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Totally. Let's do it, George. if you get that reference, send a message on our social media page. If you don't get that reference, you should be more in tune with the world of politics. Oh, goodness me. So, let's go to the cast real quick. And there are going to be four names that you don't know. There's Scott Wiener and Brad Kane, who voiced Aladdin. There's Linda Larkin and Leah Salonga, who voiced Princess Jasmine. And they're singing voices.
Okay, so they had different people.
Yeah,
that's interesting because I don't know. I mean, I'm a professional singer, and for years I always thought that they were voicing the singing. You know, the singing people were this one and the same. But that's incredible how they got that their timbre and their range and tone so close. That's really impressive.
Yeah, but you don't really know those names. With all due respect to them, you know, they're not famous.
They're not household names.
But they are very, very well known in the world of animation. Right? And the world of animated voiceover. Now, one name who's not well known in animated voiceover, but everybody knows who he is Robin Williams, who played the genie.
Yeah, I mean, he's known in other circles and as an actor and a comedian, but up until then, he'd had very little, if any, major voice work that I could think of.
No. See, voice work was its own branch of acting. So, you know, if you were an actor, you really didn't go into voice work because voice work is tedious and difficult to do. It's not an easy thing to do. It is repetitive, unlike physical acting where, yes, it might be repetitive, but you can put your own spin on stuff. You can change your motions a little bit.
Voice acting is way more rigid and it's way more subjective too. Like you can feel like you totally nailed it. And then the person on the other end, the producer, the client can be like, you know, I don't really like that. And they can just nitpick one little thing. Oh, your pace is too slow. It's too fast. Yeah. And they can totally, since you're only giving them audio, it has to, even though they can't see you, like your tone and your timbre and your energy, there's so much that goes into it. I think people probably take it for granted. They think it's easy. It's really not at all. John's absolutely right.
Definitely.
even just delivering like a couple of paragraphs in like a business tone flawlessly with good pace, it takes a little bit of practice. It takes a lot of practice.
Oh yeah.
And then people gotta want your voice, and then you have to know the technical aspect if you're recording yourself. I mean, you didn't often see actors that did both voice and acting because, like you said, it was a specialization.
Yes.
Like you would have a particular person, the guy that did all the Bugs Bunny voices.
Mel Blanc. Right?
Yeah, exactly. A guy like that. Like he didn't do much TV at all, but he did like voice acting. That's all he did.
Yeah.
But Robin Williams was one of those rare birds that could kind of, that broke into voice acting via acting. And I would argue that he opened the door for other actors to cross over into voice acting.
Yes, and that's what I was going to get to here in a minute, because now voice acting, big voice acting jobs don't go to voice actors anymore. They go to traditional actors, if that makes sense.
Seems so, yeah.
Because, I mean, the next Disney movie was The Lion King. And they had... what's his name? Ferris Bueller. I've forgotten his name. Matthew Broderick.
Matthew Broderick, yeah.
Yeah, they had him playing Simba. And they had James Earl Jones and...
That's great.
You know, great actors, great voices, but they weren't voice actors. And then as time went on, I mentioned Toy Story, you had Tom Hanks. And Tim Allen. And it just, from that point on, the big voice acting roles were going to traditional actors, which kind of was a detriment to the voice acting industry.
I could see that, but also if you look at it from, like, the marketing kind of standpoint. Yeah. I mean, even though you're not going to see Tim Allen or Tom Hanks in these respective movies, they're still going to be a draw, and people will go simply because his character, because Woody is going to be Tom Hanks, et cetera, et cetera.
They're a bigger draw than, say, Tara Strong, who does a lot of voice work.
And you've probably heard a lot of it and loved it and not even known that she was doing it.
Definitely.
And that's kind of the downfall. Okay, voice actors, they're the kind of like, they're the batteries of the media industry.
Yes.
Like, everybody uses batteries, like we rely on them, but they're always hidden. Like, every battery, there's a little panel hiding it or some kind of screw or, you know, they're out of the way. It's not a visible product.
Yeah.
You hear it when you see an ad... And there's a voiceover. It doesn't say in the bottom corner, voiceover by Mike Martindale, you know, with his little business card. And that doesn't work that way. He just voices that, sends it to them, moves on. So it's like they seriously get underappreciated because of that. And I'm with you. Like, it's literally taking food out of their mouths to do this. But from a marketing standpoint, you got Tom Hanks voicing your lead. I mean, come on, dude.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, and like I said, it's no disrespect to any of these actors who go into it.
Oh, they're great.
They're great when they do it. It's just, sadly, you know, it's again, off the, taking the, as you said, taking food out of the mouths of people. Now, if you make it to the top, you know, that's different. I mentioned Tara Strong earlier. For those of you who don't know, she plays Harley Quinn in the Batman animated series. She played Dill Pickles. She played Bubbles in the Powerpuff Girls.
You know, see, we kind of know more about that than most, too, I would offer, because we work in that industry.
Yes.
You know, but the same respect, like, yeah, I'm happy to like, get anybody's name out there, because we've been enjoying these people blindly for decades, some of us, and, you know, they've been just kind of the quiet heroes of our childhood. You know, I can't tell you who voiced Dexter from Dexter's Lab. No clue. But that voice is a part of my childhood.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like... So there's some unsung like hero stuff going on there, Finn.
Well, that's gonna bother me now.
Oh God!
So I'm gonna pull it up. But as I pull it up, Robin Williams, right? He was the hottest act in Hollywood at that time.
Oh, undoubtedly, yeah. I mean, he was a rising star. He was kind of the '80s Jim Carrey, if you will.
Yeah.
In a way, like, you know, Miss Doubtfire and, you know, a few other ones. He was really proved that he could be animated, had physical comedy, could deliver really well. Just a pro through and through, and a great guy. So yeah, he's awesome.
So what happened was, and just for the record, the Dexter's Lab was played by Christine Cavanaugh and Candy Marlowe.
See, and we've never, like, it wasn't like, it wasn't Miley Cyrus and Selena Gomez. You know what I mean? It was like, just, it was two really good voice actors that were just quietly kicking butt, and we didn't really even know that they were doing it.
And Christine Cavanaugh is actually in this movie, so.
Really?
Yes. She does additional voices. So.
Okay, cool.
Yeah. So anyway.
How about that?
Anyway, Robin Williams, hottest act, right? And he was demanding between $6 and $10 million for a movie, which, you know, equates to what, 20 to 40 million now these days.
Yeah, and keep in mind that's just for voice acting.
Yeah,
there's no makeup, costumes, sets, locations, no travel, or, you know, I mean, nothing substantial. No like site travel. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So
that's pretty crazy.
So the filmmaker said, "Look, we want to use you." And animated the genie to some of Williams' stand-up routines, which was smart, because now you got the character of what he looks like, sending it to the person of what he's supposed to sound like. you know, this is what we want you to do. Williams thought that was so funny, he accepted the role for basic SAG pay, which is around $75,000, only if two conditions were met. His name and image were not used in marketing of the movie, and his character does not take up no more than 25% of marketing materials.
You know, I'm blown away by that, because I guess the word of mouth spread.
Yeah.
Solely, like, he, because basically what that is, without going too far off, he basically pulled a Foo Fighters. Like, when Dave Grohl released the first Foo Fighters album, yeah, he did not disclose who he was or that he was from Nirvana. He just put out an album called Foo Fighters, and people started buying it. And then eventually, he's like, dropped the veil. It's like, okay, yeah, it's me, Dave Grohl. And we were like, yay! And then we watched him make music for decades, and it was amazing.
Yes.
So, yeah, it was kind of the same thing. Like, we talked about this last week. We were talking about deals. I wonder if that was free and clear. Like, the Jeff Daniels deal, it was similar, was it not?
Oh, yeah. And Jeff Daniels got $50,000. So Robin Williams got $75,000. So they got, for $125,000, you've got, you know, two really, really talented artists in your movie.
Wow.
All you've got to do is push one to the side and act like you don't want him, or renege on all your promises that you made after the recording is done. Because that's what Disney did. See, okay, what happened was, the test screenings had positive results, so they used the genie scenes in the trailer and all the promotional materials. They made him 25% of the poster, like they said, but they made all the other characters smaller around him.
So a perspective slant. Yes. So he's huge.
But they couldn't mention Robin Williams by name, so they just said the actor cast as the genie. And
you know, they worked within the confines of that contract. I gotta say,
that's malicious compliance to a T right there.
Yeah, that's a perfect way to put that, man. I'm gonna tattoo that on my knuckles now. I like that.
Williams was not happy. He was apoplectic and refused to work ever again with Disney if Jeff Katzenberg was the head of the studio.
Wow. So boom, that was it.
Yep. So this led to Dan Castellaneta being cast as the genie in sequels, and Robin Williams vowed never to work with Disney again. He did. He worked on the sequel. But just think of how many movies missed out on Robin Williams.
How many we?
Yeah.
We missed out on that, dude. Like,
definitely. Because, you know, I mean,
so yeah, totally. Probably at least a handful, I'd argue.
I mean, he'd have done great in A Bug's Life.
I mean, Robin Williams is so versatile, dude. Like, you could have put him in anything. I mean, you could have made him Darkwing Duck, and he didn't work. Like, it's British, you know, like South American. Like, I mean, whatever. Like, he was just he's just like a chameleon, just incredible.
Oh my word! We've got four pages of plot here. So let's get into the plot real quick. Street peddler Robin Williams is guiding the audience through the streets of the fictional Arabian city of Agrabah, trying to sell all kinds of wares. He pulls out an old oil lamp, once changed the course of a young man's life, a young man who, like this lamp, was more than what he seemed, a diamond in the rough. Mystical already. So the peddler begins to tell the tale, beginning on a dark night where the Sultan's Grand Vizier Jafar has a secret meeting with a thief named Kazim. Kazim hands over half a golden scrab beetle, to which Jafar already possesses the other half. Putting both halves together, the golden scrab beetle comes to life and flies off into the night. It settles on the Cave of Wonders.
Ooh. Yes.
Nice.
It's one of the coolest parts of the movie, I thought, when I first saw it.
Oh, yeah, that was awesome. Old computer animation, but it worked so well with the traditional animation style.
Yeah, I mean, whatever. Yeah, and it still looks really good, too. They did a really good job on it. Oh, yeah.
So Jafar orders Kazim into the cave to retrieve the lamp. However, only whose worth lies within, the diamond in the rough. Kazim still attempts to enter the cage, but he takes one step inside the tiger's mouth, and it kills him instantly by closing off the entranceway. So Jafar understands he needs to find a diamond in the rough. Okay, that's a decent start to the movie. You know who the bad guy is straight away.
Sure.
You know,
I mean, Disney does a good job of like stylizing their villains.
Yes.
Like, the villains always have like a certain palette and a certain like angles. They'll make their eyebrows like a little sharper, you know, just these little
square
evil mustache. Yeah, they're just, there's always, and then everybody, and the heroes are always very curved and very just very friendly looking, you know.
Yes.
Yeah, but they always draw them kind of evil. And so Jafar, right out of the box, like, before he opens his mouth, you're like, boom, bad guy.
That's the bad guy.
Boom.
Might as well be wearing a neon sign flashing saying bad guy, bad guy.
Oh, yeah, he might as well have tattooed on his forehead. Yeah, exactly. The get up, the posture, the tone, the energy, all of it. Yeah, every bit of it.
So the next day on the streets of Agrabah, a young street urchin called Aladdin is struggling to steal a loaf of bread along with his pet monkey, Apu. After outwitting some of the city guards, the two settle down to eat the spoils, but end up giving it away to a couple of hungry kids. They are then distracted when the royal prince marches through the streets en route to the Sultan's palace to claim the princess's hand. Aww, arranged marriages.
Yeah.
Aladdin gets into a confrontation with the prince when he tries to punish two kids who mistakenly walk in front of his house, causing it to stop abruptly. The prince kicks Aladdin into a puddle of dirt and declares Aladdin to be nothing but a worthless street rat. Aladdin and Apu retire to their abode, with Aladdin promising his monkey that someday things will get better. I mean, it's a monkey. He doesn't understand you.
Yeah.
I mean, he's...
most Disney animals are quasi-sentient.
Yeah, that's true.
But yeah, your average monkey, he would be like... He would just be like, probably try to eat you while you slept. I mean, if times got hard enough, you know what I mean? Like, I don't know what monkeys normally eat, but I mean, an animal do weird and crazy things to survive.
There you go. So the next day, the prince leaves the palace angered. The princess Jasmine has fended off his advances, allowing her pet tiger to rip out the suitor's pants.
Yeah, that was funny.
That was funny in a way, right? He's got the underwear. The dude walks out, right, and you could see that his robe has been ripped, and he's wearing like these heart underwear, right?
Right.
With smiley face or something on them.
Classic heart boxers, yeah.
And okay, fair enough. That's funny, right? But then it comes out to the tiger who's got the pants in his mouth,
right?
The same ones that he's wearing. So did he rip the front off too? I mean,
okay. Little continuity break there.
Come on, Disney. You can do better than that.
Yeah. $60 million movie. Yeah, come on, man.
Especially with the amount of money that you make, you could touch it up afterwards. You could fix the bugs. So the daughter's tired. So the Sultan talks to his daughter, Jasmine, who's tired of living a life being cooped up behind the city walls. The Sultan confronts with Jafar, who's his advisor, and claims with the help of the Sultan, if the Sultan give him a blue diamond ring. Upon hypnosis, the Sultan gives Jafar the ring and retreats to his private quarters. Oh, so Jafar has magic skills.
Yeah, he looks like a wizard, so that tracks 100%.
Definitely. Later that evening, Jasmine escapes from the palace and begins wandering the streets of Agrabah. However, her act of giving an apple to a hungry boy lands her in trouble with the street merchant for not realizing she would have to pay. Luckily, Aladdin intervenes and calls the merchant to believe in he got his apple back, and leads Jasmine away from the market and away from further trouble.
Yeah, he saved her. He saved her because they sing a song somewhere around there about how they'll straight up just cut your hand off if you get caught stealing. And Jasmine, being, you know, in a palace, she didn't have to ever worry about those things. She could just go and grab whatever she wanted out of the kitchen or whatever. So that was totally foreign to her. It's a totally different worldview.
That's a little stereotypy too.
Yeah, it kind of is. But I mean, also it's an apple. But I mean, I guess I know we're looking at a different worldview, a different, you know, perspective and whatnot. But yeah, that's pretty hardcore. Like just all together. Yeah.
Here's an apple. I'll take your hand for it. I mean.
Yeah, that's not bad trade. Like, I'm gonna need way more apples, man.
Yeah, at least like, let me take more. A bushel.
Yeah. You got any that are fermented I can make some wine out of, so right. I can, you know, nurse this missing hand thing I'm about to have.
So Jafar uses the blue diamond ring he stole from the Sultan to consult the Sands of Time, which reveal who he needs to enter the Cave of Wonders. Wouldn't it just so happen to be this kid called Aladdin?
Yep.
That's a little coincidence, isn't it?
Yeah, very convenient to move the plot forward, certainly. Yeah.
Aladdin is retreated with Jasmine to his and Apu's place, and she's rather taken in by his kindness. However, Aladdin is suddenly attacked and captured by the city guards. Jasmine reveals herself to them, demanding Aladdin be released, but the head of the royal guards tells us he's acting under orders from Jafar. Oh. So Tom Gods did it. I wonder if they took an arrow in the knee. Returning to the palace, Jasmine confronts Jafar, who explains that Aladdin was captured because he kidnapped her. When Jasmine reveals she escaped and the palace on her own and Aladdin had nothing to do with it, Jafar shockingly claims that Aladdin has already been executed, sending her running away in tears. Wow, that's dark for a kid's movie.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, there's a couple of times, like, I mean, where I feel like Disney has just gone for it. Like the Bambi thing. Like, oh, dude, like that, that really messed me up. Also another one, Neverending Story.
The horse.
Oh, yeah. Dude, like that was excruciating. Also, what was the other one? My Girl?
Yes.
Yeah, the death in that one. Oh, dude. Like, I we were watching it at summer camp, and there was 15 little girls crying. I was like, dude, can we watch Transformers?
No, don't watch Transformers.
Come on, man. Like, no. Ninja Turtles? Like,
Don't,
like,
don't watch Transformers. You watch Optimus Prime die.
This is like Debbie Down Central, man. Like, we need something a little peppier for our summer vacay, but, you know. But yeah, that is super dark in retrospect. Yeah.
For those wondering, by the way, it was decided on in the Lion King episode that the most tragic death of any character in a kids' TV show was Auntie from Honey, I Shrunk the Kids.
Oh, that was a bad one too. He was so adorable.
Yeah.
Yeah, because he was helpful. Yep. He was a protector. He was transportation.
They tamed him, and he protected them to his death.
He was easy to feed. He was really a source of food because he found food for them on several occasions. I just have to watch out for the now giant ant turds falling out of him. And other than that, I mean, I wouldn't want to be crushed by a boulder of that for sure.
No.
So,
but that was
a bad one too. Yeah.
Yeah, but don't watch Transformers because that gives you Optimus Prime's death, and that's no.
Yeah, I don't think they axe any of the Ninja Turtles. I think we're safe on that one.
No, they just throw the dude in a garbage compactor and compact him.
They make him look weird now, so they might as well be.
Right.
Yeah, it's like, ugh.
So, Aladdin is not executed. He's actually imprisoned in the royal dungeons. Apu managed to free Aladdin, but they are interrupted by an older prisoner claiming he needs Aladdin's help to locate the Cave of Wonders. This prisoner is actually Jafar in disguise, who manages to help Aladdin escape the dungeon.
That is two parts sneaky, or one part sneaky and one part brilliant.
Yes.
I gotta say, like, he might be a conniving scoundrel, but he is smart.
Well, yeah, you've got to be
that was smart.
When you are a conniving scoundrel with a convoluted plan, you have to be intelligent to do it.
You got to be one step ahead. You got to be playing chess.
Yes, while everybody else is playing checkers.
Well, in this case, Aladdin doesn't even know he's
got
owns
pieces.
A chess set or a checker set. Like, he hasn't even gone to the store and thought about buying it. Like, he's so in the dark here. Like, so, like, Jafar has so much on him right now, so it's a miracle, you know, that it ended how it did, you know, honestly.
All he knows is that he has to escape. So that's why he's following him. So the group arrive at the Cave of Wonders with Aladdin allowed to enter. The cave warned him not to touch anything but the lamp. That's important.
Yes.
Aladdin and Abu venture deep down in the caverns filled with treasures, gold, jewelries, gems, all kinds of luxuries, where they first encounter a sentient magic carpet that leads them to the lamp's location. Magic carpet.
Well, they told them not to touch anything.
Yeah.
And they're touching the ground?
Ah.
You must fly. You can only fly. So, yeah.
That's why you need the magic carpet for.
As I was about to say, yeah, there's the exception right there. All right.
Aladdin can retrieve the lamp, but Apu breaks the rule and picks up a large ruby, causing the cave to begin to collapse on them. Using the carpet, Aladdin and Apu manage to escape to the entrance of the cave, where the old beggar pleads for Aladdin to give him the lamp. Aladdin does so, and the beggar then reveals a dagger intended to kill him. Uh-oh. Luckily, Apu bites the beggar, and both Aladdin and Apu fall back into the cavern as the giant tiger's head disappears under the sand once again.
And then Jafar got a weird monkey disease and died. The end.
The end.
Nah.
Jafar laughingly reaches for the lamp to find out it's gone. Apu manages to steal it back off the beggar before he fell into the cave with Aladdin.
Smooth
move, monkey. Well done. Deep within the cave, Aladdin begins to examine the lamp, finding a worn inscription on the side of it. Rubbing the lamp to read the inscription produces a large blue genie. The genie tells Aladdin that rubbing the lamp, he's entitled to 3 wishes, and that wishing for more wishes is not an option, but warns you can't do the 3 things. You can't kill anyone, you can't make anyone fall in love with somebody, and you can't bring people back from the dead.
All fair rules. The first one, though, what's the fun in that? What if you wish for more genies?
Yes.
Or more lamps?
I wish for another lamp.
That's a solid loophole right there, yeah. Okay.
Maybe he needs to close that one. That gives, you know, something else, too. That gives, you know, if you wish for more genies, then you get second wish, more friends.
Boom.
Using his street smarts, Aladdin manages to con the genie into getting them out, not before having one of the best musical numbers of the entire movie.
Oh, yeah.
That's the thing about the synopsis. It doesn't give the musical numbers, so I apologize for that. But the genie gets out of the genie is conned into letting them get out of the cave without using a wish, landing in a small desert. Aladdin contemplates what to wish for after confusing the genie, and asks the genie what he would wish for. And the genie says that he would wish for freedom, because the genie is actually a slave.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, presumably. I mean, you're tied to this thing, and you have one task to perform, and it's at the will of that person who rubs a lamp. So exactly. Yeah, it sounds like a slave to me.
Yeah, and he's always going to be this way until he's released from his freedom. That's kind of a touching subplot.
He has to be wished to freedom. There's yes. No other way out of it. So it's compassion is the only thing, and selflessness. Because, I mean, if you had 3 unbridled wishes, you could do a lot of good with that if you really wanted to. You could have bad consequences, because, like, say you said no wars. Okay, then there's no Star Wars. Then there's no storage wars. You know what I mean? Like, it could get really sticky really, really quick. So, you know, it'd be easy just to do a couple blanket wishes that you know would help humanity and move on. So, yeah, that would be very selfless to give that to them.
Yeah, and if you are a genie with a magic lamp, people are going to use you for greed. So you've got to get somebody of pure heart and pure soul to release you, which is why they needed a diamond in the rough, which is why they picked Aladdin. So the topic turns to Aladdin's wishes, and he thinks of he wants to be with Jasmine. Although he cannot make her fall in love with him, he decides to become a prince, as she is a princess, thus allowing him at least to try.
Not the worst plan ever.
Smart move.
I mean, he's leading with deception.
Yes.
Which is not the best first impression, but I mean, or not the, you know, if you look back, won't look good and might be detrimental, but I mean, how else are you going to get your foot in the door? You can't even compete with these other guys pulling up with these elephants and all these like maids and gifts and stuff. Like you gotta compete somehow. So yeah.
So Aladdin is transformed into a fabulously wealthy prince, while Apu is transferred into his giant elephant that we have Aladdin's steed.
Yeah.
Wow. Meanwhile, back in Agrippa, Jafar is still upset that he didn't get the lamp and wanted to find some way to attain power. Jafar attempts to convince the Sultan that there's a clause in the royal rules that if Jasmine has not been suitably wed by a certain time, then she must marry the great vizier to save face. The Sultan is reluctant, but Jafar hypnotizes him, but he's interrupted by loud music coming from outside.
Yeah, I remember that.
Make way for Prince Ali. Good lord, we got another 2 pages of this. This is a long synopsis for a 90-minute movie, everybody. I apologize. Outside, a large, noisy royal procession enters the kingdom to announce the arrival of Prince Ali Ababa. This is Aladdin. The procession is here. Prince Ali, glorious he.
Ali Ababa.
There we go. Genuflect, show some respect, down on one knee. I would sing it, but you don't want me singing.
It's a great song.
Yeah, it is a great song. The songs in this movie are fantastic.
Oh yeah, the score is fantastic. I think it won some awards too, I believe.
Yeah. So the procession is hewed with riches, exotic animals, servants, and Aladdin himself riding Apu. The entourage makes his way to the palace, impressing the Sultan. However, Jafar is suspicious. Well, of course he is. Aladdin is taken to Jasmine, who is unimpressed and rebuffs Aladdin's pompous ways. However, when Aladdin removes his hat to shoo away Raja, Jasmine is reminded of the street urchin. Aladdin tries to gain Jasmine's interest again by telling how rich and powerful she is, but she remains ambivalent. So he decides to leave Jasmine alone and steps off on his magic carpet, which gets her attention. Jasmine wishes to ride with him, and the two take a long trip around the world. Aladdin drops his pompous facade during the trip, which eventually wins her over.
Now, he kind of becomes himself. He gets a little more comfortable, settles in, using the ride and the carpet as sort of a vessel to do that.
Wasn't it you who sent me that clip that was the real sound of what would happen if they were on the magic carpet?
Yeah. So, real quick. So for people, for like audio people, sound people, you know, when you're trying to catch audio in different areas, like if you're outdoors, you're dealing with elements, et cetera, it can be quite challenging. So basically what this is, it's a YouTube video. It's a couple minutes long. And it's the clip of the carpet ride that they take where they're singing A Whole New World, but with realistic audio, a.k.a. they're zooming around in the up in the sky in a magic carpet, probably doing, 60? So it's just like... Yeah, just... And then you can kind of hear the singing in the background that's kind of covered up by it. And then, there's a faraway shot... Like, it's just as realistic as possible. Because if they were that far away, you wouldn't hear them singing.
No.
You wouldn't hear wind. You wouldn't hear anything. It would just be like ambient, you know, noise outside. So, yeah. Look up on YouTube realistic Aladdin realistic audio. I believe that's what I keyworded it for it. Yeah. When I heard we were doing this episode, I sent it to him because we're both audio engineers. And yes. It's so true. It's so perfect.
But. They would have had to have been traveling at 500 miles an hour to go around the world as quickly as they did in those 3 minutes.
Yeah, that presents a lot of issues.
That would have peeled their skin off their bones.
Plus, yeah, I was about to say, because it's really cold up in the air.
Yes.
Like, people don't realize this, but when you get up to the outer atmosphere, it's below freezing.
Oh, yeah. If you've ever been on a plane, it'll tell you the temperature outside.
It's super, super cold, and so the ground is what heats everything up. That's why. That's how we get our warmth. The sun hits the ground, and it gets warm, and then it heats everything, the air up around it. And that's why it's 3-4 o'clock is the hottest part of the day.
Yeah,
because we've had all day of that sun just baking on the earth.
Well, that's certain areas of the world are warmer than others. It's not just their geographical location, but it's their level to sea level.
Yeah, that's
the closer you are to sea level, the hotter it is.
Absolutely, because there's more ground. You know, baking around you and whatnot. So yeah, their carpet ride defies all known audio logic and all natural physics and limitations of the human body. But still, it's a very touching and very cool little scene that's very, very memorable.
Yeah. So, returning to the palace, Aladdin is roughly seized by palace guards who tie him up and dump him in a nearby lake under orders from Jafar. When he rubs the lamp, the genie appears and coaxes Aladdin to use his second wish to save his life. Aladdin returns to the palace to find that Jafar's been using his cobra-shaped staff to once again hypnotize the Sultan, demanding that he order Jasmine to marry him. Aladdin figures out Jafar's schemes and smashes the staff. Jafar vanishes before the palace guards can arrest him, but not before spotting the lamp hidden inside Prince Ali's hat. After he's gone, the Sultan sees that Jasmine has accepted Aladdin and wishes to marry him. Aww. However, Aladdin is still troubled by the fact that he's not a real prince, and he's been lying the whole time.
I mentioned that.
Yep. Genie tries to coax Aladdin to use his last wish to free him, and Aladdin says he can't free the genies, he wouldn't be the prince that he is without him. Wow.
Yeah, that's kind of a move, really. Yeah, I mean, and he's definitely not happy about it, but I think understandably so. I mean, he's been trapped in there a while, so who knows when this opportunity may come again.
Oh, yeah, he feels angry and betrayed.
Totally. I can see that.
Jafar returns to his secret lair beneath the palace, seemingly defeated but laughing hysterically when he realizes who Prince Ali really is. He then sends his pet parrot, Iago, played by the great Gilbert Gottfried,
God rest his soul,
yes, to steal the lamp, which he does rather easily. Jafar summons the genie, and genie's forced to do Jafar's bidding and appears to be in gigantic form, grabbing the palace and taking it to a remote mountain. Jafar uses his first wish to become the world's most powerful sorcerer and reveals to everyone Aladdin is nothing more than a street urchin and launches him out of the palace in a makeshift rocket, which he lands in a snowy cold mountain region.
So that had to be really far away.
Oh, yeah. Well, not really far away, because if you have high mountains in that area... they're going to be snow-capped.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, and it is figurative. So, yeah, you're right. The desert could be down at sea level, and then you could have mountains where the air is, you know, quote unquote, thinner, yeah, very, very close by. So yeah, I guess it's, that's in a feasible world. I guess it makes sense.
Jafar uses his second wish to become Sultan and imprisons the actual Sultan and the princess until she agrees to marry him.
Because that's how you start off a marriage.
Yes, you will be my wife or else.
Perfect. That's how you do it.
Yes. Not. Right. I mean, I've just been playing Monkey Island, which has got a similar plot line. And but that's a comedy video game. You know, it's,
yeah,
it's,
I mean, Mario's kind of that, isn't it?
Yeah.
Is Koopa trying to, I mean, I don't know, Koopa's never really clear on his intentions.
Ew.
If you really think about it, like, he's really not. But I don't, but I always assumed that's what it was. Like, he was just, he thought the princess was hot and was trying to, you know, marry her or something.
Well, we'll find out his motivation when the Mario movie comes out in a couple of weeks.
I can't wait, man. I've got Mario themes set on all my devices. So every time I turn on, it's like, like the, when you supersize, it's awesome.
Nice. Trapped in the mountains, Aladdin finds Apu with the magic carpet and they can return to Agrabah. They sneak into the palace and they find the genie, who warns him he can't help him since Jafar holds the lamp. Aladdin tries to sneak up on Jafar and steal the lamp back. Jasmine sees Aladdin's plan and uses Jafar's wish for her to be in love with him as an excuse to pretend that she's suddenly enraptured with Jafar to distract him.
Yeah, that's, I always thought that was weird when I was a kid. I was, she was getting kind of seductive a little bit.
Yeah.
I always thought that was, I mean, Disney walked the line on a lot of things, but that one was just like, ooh. All right. A little saucy there, Disney.
A little saucy. Hoo-wee. Jafar sees Aladdin's reaction to Jasmine's tiara and knocks him away, and then traps Jasmine in a large hourglass where she eventually be submerged in the sand and die.
Yeah, such a gentleman.
Yeah, I know, right? Who wouldn't want to marry this guy?
Yeah, he's great.
Jafar transforms himself into a giant cobra to terrorize Aladdin, who fights back valiantly. While trapped in the snake Jafar's coil, Aladdin taunts him. And Mix Jafar uses third wish, telling Jafar that he, no matter how powerful he gets, the genie will be more powerful. Jafar falls for the ruse and wishes to be turned into an all-powerful genie. Genie complies. Now remember, genies are trapped in a lamp for a lifetime of slavery.
Right.
In the words of the genie himself, phenomenal cosmic power in itty-bitty living space.
Yeah.
So when the genie complies, Jafar changes form, which frees Aladdin so he can run to Jasmine's hourglass and break it out before he suffocates. As Jafar revels in his newfound power, Aladdin reminds him that being a genie also means becoming to a servant to whoever holds the lamp.
Yep.
Jafar is suddenly shackled and sucked into his new lamp created by his wish and is trapped forever.
Just didn't think that one through all the way.
He was a little hasty.
Because he's at someone's mercy, like we were saying before. So if that lamp goes untouched, then he just sits there in that tiny little area for
eternity.
Who knows how long.
The genie takes the lamp and throws it into the desert, where it lands in the Cave of Wonders as a brand new lamp. The genie then tells Aladdin that if he wants to use his third wish to become a prince again, he can. However, Aladdin wishes the genie free. The lamp becomes inactive and the genie's shackle falls off his wrist. Aww.
That's very cool of him.
That's very nice of him. Overjoyed Definitely. That he's no longer a servant, the genie plans a trip around the world. The Sultan, however, knowing that Aladdin is not the prince, decides to let him marry his daughter anyway, seeing how much Aladdin and Jasmine care for each other.
Because that's how that would work.
Yes. Abu is changed back into his monkey form, and the genie leaves the emotional goodbye. Aladdin and the princess are married, and Aladdin becomes heir to the kingdom. They fly away on Aladdin's magic carpet to the moon, which turns into the laughing genie's face. Suddenly the film is lifted by the genie, who says, "Mid you look," and that's Aladdin.
They fly towards the moon. There's no oxygen there. There's no water. It's half, you know, 250,000 miles away. Where
are they going to get through?
What are you doing?
How are they going to get through the atmosphere?
Yeah. What kind of this does the carpet have escape velocity? Because that's damn impressive. Like, talk about ripping your face off. I think that would pulverize you if you weren't in a capsule.
Right. Imagine the wind shear on that one. Oh.
Oh. Yeah.
So, basically, put this movie right here. Does have cameos from Pinocchio, the Beast, and Sebastian from Little Mermaid.
Nice.
And the genie's outfit at the end of the movie is based on an outfit Robin Williams once wore to a short Disney MGM tour. Nice.
Huh.
So the opening scene, right, the bit with the peddler, Robin Williams is sat at a table and asked to improvise. And in front of him is all these objects. And the line, "will not break, will not break," it broke, actually happened. He was tapping something on the table and it broke, and he's like, it broke.
Awesome.
Now, Jafar was voiced by Jonathan Freeman.
Relatively unknown compared to Robin Williams.
Do you know who the first choice for Jafar was?
It says right here, Patrick Stewart.
Yes.
Yeah, I think that could have worked.
But he had conflictions with Next Generation and caused him to pull out of the project, which, man, that would have been something. That would have been scarier if it was Patrick Stewart.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, he has just a very commanding, like, tone and just a very, like, it's this buttery kind of baritone. But I think for what it's worth, the guy that they got was really good. He was very ominous and very dark, like they were shooting for. So it worked.
Definitely. I mean, okay, Patrick Stewart, right, was in The Elder Scrolls IV Oblivion. And right. They gave him an 80-page character treatment of the character he was going to play. And the character right. died in the tutorial level. But his narration for the opening scene and his voice during the whole thing, he could have pulled off voice acting, is basically where I'm going with this.
Oh, totally. Yeah, no, Patrick Stewart's got a ton of theater training, and he does voice work for American Dad as yes. well as the director Bullock. And honestly, to me, that's one of the best parts of the entire show. So definitely Patrick Stewart was qualified and still is. Absolutely.
Patrick Stewart is overqualified.
Oh, definitely. But I mean, he's a lover of the arts. He's the kind of person that would, you know, take less money to do a cool project.
Yeah.
Like Betty White did a lot of that in her last days. Like she did Community, had a recurring role as like a archaeology professor or something. It was more of a extended cameo, but nonetheless, like, I mean, you don't get Betty White because you have a huge budget. You get Betty White because she's cool.
Yeah, Betty White because she's Betty White. Exactly.
Exactly.
You get so Patrick Stewart because of Patrick Stewart.
He's kind of like that. I bet you anything, he doesn't drain American Dad's
coffers
account, you know, or their budget at all. Bet you not.
So, this movie is a musical. Let's go over the five songs that were quickly. The five songs that we used in the movie, which for a musical, five songs isn't much.
Yeah, there was a lot of dialogue. It was dialogue heavy mostly, but the songs did a lot of heavy lifting though.
Oh yeah.
For how few there were, I think they add a lot of exposition, a lot of background, and a lot of color. So they did a lot for.
Yeah, Robin Williams sung his song, and they used Broadway actors to do the rest of them. So the voice actors voiced the Broadway singers, Broadway sung, and then Robin Williams did both because he's Robin Williams.
Sure, yeah. And that, like I was saying earlier, they did a really good job of matching the tone and the range and the timbre of the natural speaking voices.
Yes.
Because, say, you had, you know, Gilbert Gottfried voicing and then James Earl Jones singing. You know what I mean? Like, that just, there's no, you're not going to believe that. But they did it in a way, like anytime Disney, like whether it's Ariel or Prince Ali or any, you know, they're always going to match that as good as they can. And I honestly had no clue that that was even a thing until I started looking at hard at the research. So yeah, that's really impressive.
So the songs that were featured were Arabian Nights, sung by Robin Williams at the very, very beginning of the movie.
Yeah.
That doesn't do any heavy lifting. That's just a song for the sake of a song, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, sure.
Then you've got the song that introduces who Aladdin is.
Yeah.
Then you got the song that introduces the genie, Friend Like Me.
It shows off what he can do and
yes,
what he's been through and a little more exposition on him.
Then you got Prince Ali that introduces who Prince Ali is.
Kind of boasts him, builds him up a little bit, and propels that next part of the story where Jasmine becomes, you know, interested in him.
And then you have A Whole New World, which is basically Jasmine's song. Even though she doesn't sing it, she's got the harmonies down really, really well.
Yeah, it's a duet. It's kind of like an Endless Love where they both sing and then they harmonize. There's harmonization and there's unison. They sing together, but yeah, it's a very good song. It's one of the most popular Disney songs of all time.
Yes. So as far as I'm concerned, this is a 9 out of 10 movie.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just you know, groundbreaking film, opened the doors for the industry in a lot of ways. Well made, holds up well, well done, good top to bottom. Yeah, 9.5, totally.
Definitely. And not just that, I mean, okay, look, Robin Williams, let's take Robin Williams out of the equation for a minute because his performance is off the chart.
Sure.
Right. Everybody else kept up with Robin Williams. As we mentioned with Jeff Daniels in the Dumb and Dumber episode, he kept up with Jim Carrey. Everybody else kept up with Robin Williams.
Yeah.
The music doesn't overstay its welcome and is sung by the cast as opposed to being overlaid to what's happening. So you've got the Circle of Life, which is like, you know, nobody's singing that. It's just a song over the action.
Sure.
Where you've got Friend Like Me, which is the genie singing his song.
The characters are actually singing it instead of it being like a soundtrack.
Yes. Yes, yeah. Definitely. Princess Jasmine is stronger than any Disney princess to that date, which I think I agree with. I think that's, you know. It changed the tone of animated musicals, but it did, again, it did bring in superstars to voice as opposed to voice talent people.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's just what it was. And I mentioned it had sequels. The sequels to to Aladdin actually held up better than the sequels to The Lion King and to Little Mermaid and Beauty and the Beast.
Right.
So, what's your opinion on it, man?
Yeah, I mean, I was 9 when it came out, so I enjoyed it very much as a kid. I think it's still a very worthwhile watch today. It's got a lot of merit as far as from the production standpoint. And also the score, the music is really, really good. Like you were saying, I do like how it's intertwined into the movie instead of being overlaid over the top, like a background soundtrack. That's definitely very, very good. Robin Williams is absolutely spectacular. I think you don't have the same movie without him. He's your linchpin. Even though presumably Prince Ali is the main character, or whatever, Aladdin is the main character, he kind of steals the show.
Yeah,
so trying to shoehorn anyone else in there, like I think maybe it would have went well, say, if they had Dan Castellaneta as the genie for that one, but I don't think they would have seen anywhere near the success that they saw. Yeah, Robin Williams absolutely sold that, and he's forever will be legendarily known from that performance.
Definitely. And, you know, it's a shame Robin Williams didn't work on more animated stuff, because he would have nailed it out of the park. I think this one burnt him a little bit.
Yeah, and with everything that happened with his demands and all that, it's a shame, because as much stuff as Robin Williams did, we could all use more Robin Williams.
Yes, so shame he's not with us anymore, but...
Yeah, hey, if you've never seen any of his early work, check out the series Mork and Mindy.
Yeah.
It's a 70s series. It's really, really good. It's really, really funny. He's
just Robin Williams.
Yeah, but it's the younger version of him, so he's way more over the top, like really, really leaning into physical. There's some good pranks on there too, that it's a great show. So check that out if you like the Robin Williams.
Sweet. And of course, my thing is, if you're an older listener, you're not one of the kids listening to this, check out some of his stand-up work too. Some of his stand-up work is absolutely hilarious.
Oh yeah, yeah. He has this bit about how he went to a restroom, but he didn't get much rest. it's with really him. It's not. It's the words too. But he's another one of those guys like Jim Carrey, where he knows how to deliver and he knows how to like time things and to read a room and stuff like that. So when you watch it. I'm not even doing it justice, but there's this whole thing about how things are named weird. Yeah, he does really good observational comedy. Very, very good.
And he's very quick-witted, too. And the way I describe his comedy is it's ADD comedy.
Oh,
He doesn't stay on one topic long enough for you to get interested in it. He just jumps to the next one straight away with no transition.
Have you ever been to grocery stores? Grocery stores. Oh, stores. Who likes stores? Oh, I don't like them. I liking things. Yeah. It's just constantly just like, but that's part of the charm.
Yes.
Is that there's a lot for like us with short attention spans. I mean, he really massages my brain when I hear him talk, because he's got so much going on. You know?
That's right. So with that being said, Greg, man, thank you for coming on board. I appreciate you.
Yeah, dude.
We will see you here in a couple of weeks with Sonic the Hedgehog. Or Speed. I don't know which one is which in order, but we're going to do Sonic the Hedgehog and Speed, so that's going to be a good thing.
Okay, so the original Sonic the Hedgehog?
Actually, Sonic 1, 2, and 3.
Oh, okay, we're going to do the
trilogy. 1, 2, and
3. Awesome, yeah, I'm a big fan of all three of those. That's what got me into Sega, so I'm looking forward to that.
There we go, and that will be in a couple of weeks, Tom. Meanwhile, I will talk about what's coming up next week and what's coming up on our YouTube channel here in a couple of minutes. Greg's been awesome to have you on, and we'll see you here in a little while.
Heck yeah, man. Peace.
Serious thank you to Greg Gregory for taking the time out of his day to come and talk to us about Aladdin. I know he's been very, very super busy, and getting him is a real treat for everybody. I like working with Greg. I like working with Sarah. I like working with everybody on the podcast, but it's just been a pain to try and get together, and it's been really, really good that we have gone together and talked about some of the stuff the last couple of weeks. Greg is going to take a couple of weeks off as Sarah returns next week as we pay tribute to some of the musicians who passed away in the 1990s. Either they were important to the 90s, or they were important before the 90s and just so happened to pass away in the 90s. Okay, we're going to pay tribute to some of the legends of music, to why they were important, and to what impact they had on music in general, not just in the 90s, okay? And I'm going to be joined by Sarah to talk about that. It's going to be a two-part episode, so bring your napkins, bring your tears, and we're going to talk about some of the best and the brightest, okay? This week on our YouTube channel, we continue our playthrough of Monkey Island 3, The Curse of Monkey Island, and we're almost to the end of the season. The end of the season is going to be the end of the season, and then after that, the 90s gamer is going to take a brief hiatus while we figure out what game to play next. The 90s gamer is a little different to a dead stream. In the 90s games are really, really quick to go through. I was doing some research and I found a bunch of games that are only like 35 minutes to an hour long, and that's the long play version of it, which, you know, looking back now, $20, $30 for a game, you know, that only costs you an hour to beat. I mean, I joke about Skyrim all the time, but I mean, good lord, it was only a couple of months ago that I managed to get the last achievement, and I don't play with mods, so that's what I'm saying. It takes a long time to play modern games, but some of these are 30 minutes long and are not suitable for the 90s gamer, so I'm gonna have to figure out another game that we can play in this break and learn how to play it if I don't know how to play it already, and bring you a comprehensive playthrough of it, okay? I don't want to shortchange you guys, but I also don't want to rush into something, and, you know, I want to bring you content, but I don't want to rush in to give you bad content, if that makes sense, okay? And that is it for this episode. It has been a tiring week here at Castle Connolly, and I'm glad to put my feet up and get some rest. It is Friday when I'm recording this, so I look forward to the weekend, although I can't look forward to the weekend. I've got a stream coming up tomorrow, and if you've been watching the last couple of weeks, the first stream of our Paper Mario series over on Dad Streamer on our Twitch channel. So if you haven't watched, go ahead and watch this up on YouTube right now, and it's still on Twitch. If you watch replays of Twitch streams, go check out twitch.tv/DadStreamer, or go check out our YouTube page where the link is in the comments in the description below, okay? And that is it. Everybody, take it easy. Eat healthy, go ahead and exercise, get some fresh air, hydrate. It's important that you hydrate. And once again, I don't know what I'm saying. It's the end of the episode, and I will talk to you next week, okay? Take it easy, everybody. Bye.